To present the next speaker, we have Oskar Westlund, who is a professor of digital journalism here at Oslo Met. Most of you know him. He's also the editor of Digital Journalism, the research journal. Oskar, welcome. He's one of us, so I won't say much more about him.
Thank you, Roy. I just want to say on behalf of the Oslo Met Digital Journalism Research Group that we're happy to be one of the coordinators of this excellent annual conference led by Roy and Christine and Ingrid. And we're extremely grateful to be able to invite some of the most distinguished scholars in the world for this conference. And by having Silvia here, I'd say we have a person who has led the field in many different ways. Not only has he published 14 books, there are probably more coming because he's now on a sabbatical, so maybe there are some in the well, I know at least one is in the publication process. And he has led done a very important work in leading two journals, among those the flagship journal in communication, the Journal of Communication. And in doing so, it's really changed many things of how we see of research in the field. And sort of, to me, he's a sort of a role model for how we can work with journals and developing the field. And his knowledge encompasses very many different areas. So when we realized that he will focus his attention more towards online harassment and matters of safety during this year, when he's taking time off from running a journal and doing teaching and many other things, I was just thrilled knowing he can come here, but also all the things he will probably condense and synthesize and write about during his, when he actually has time to write, because he's very productive when he doesn't have time to write. So I just imagine what's going to happen now. But anyhow, we're very grateful that you're here, Silvio, and I let you enter the stage now.
Thank you very much. Is it okay? You can hear me? All right. Thank you very much, Oskar, for the invitation and the very generous introduction. Thank you to Ingrid and Roy and Kristen. It's always good to be back here and see all friends who still look remarkably young, even after all these years. So the title is slightly different from the original title, but it's basically about the same issues. So let me give you some background on how I got to what I'm going to present. So about 20 years ago, I was working on a project on investigative journalism in South America, in four countries in South America. And of course, as I was doing the research, one of the issues that I found out was central to the work was the question of violence and the permanent situation of violence, harassment, attacks. And that was 22 years ago. And that led me to becoming much more interested in anti-press attacks. And of course, eventually what I wrote was that the argument was that the state was directly responsible for much of the anti-press attacks, either because the state was the perpetrator through politicians or the police or army officials, or the state by default was the perpetrator because it failed to protect reporters. So fast forward 20 years later, and in some ways this, what I wrote back then, came back to mind in the current situation, and I never thought that I was going to think about questions related to anti-press violence in the U.S., where I have lived for three decades or so. But I teach you a lesson that if you live long enough, you will realize that things that you never thought will happen actually will happen. So not because the U.S. is totally foreign to anti-press attacks, but it's considerably different than what has been in most places around the world, at least in the global south or the countries that I knew a little bit better. And I became interested in sort of understanding online harassment of U.S. reporters in the last year or so, partially because of the unique situation for journalism, for politics in the U.S., partially because of convenience, because many friends of mine in Washington, D.C. are journalists, and many of them have been targets of sort of unheard of, unusual attacks. So that sort of a light went off in my head. So I'm like, well, how new is this? sort of something interesting, not just about this country, but about a particular time of journalism and politics around the world, in the sense that it could have, if it happens in the U.S., it is happening, or it could happen anywhere else. And that's what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do today is to share my sort of thoughts on this question. I've been doing about 30 interviews, and I'm still doing interviews every week with reporters working for national media outlets mostly, and sort of a review of what has been written in the past year on this. So Nina Kapoor yesterday used the expression of the new normal, and actually I already have this idea because it is the new normal, in terms of the new normal being online harassment of part of the work of what journalists do. And there are a number of recent reports actually documenting this, an increase in online harassment. There's a report by a number of organizations that actually document this. I will not get into the specifics. Probably many of you already know these documents. But what is interesting that when you talk to journalists who have been the target of harassment, pretty much none of them actually reported any of this. So basically what the reports do is sort of, in some ways, they're showing only the tip of the iceberg. What gets reported and disclosed is only a fraction of what happens. So that gives you a sense of the magnitude, how normal this new normal actually is. So then my next question was, so who is likely to be the target of these attacks? Not all journalists are affected similarly, and we know this from the literature on anti-press attacks. It's not the press as a whole, or all journalists who are attacked, some more than others, and already we heard something about this. So there are three dimensions that in my mind explain who is more likely to be attacked. One is matters of social identity. I will get into this in 1 minute. Second is the newsfeed, what reporters cover. And the third one is what are the news organizations that they work for. So on social identity, my interests here are on markers of social identity. What sort of the public believes somebody is because of the conventional markers of being a woman or being part of a minority or a religious group, so on and so forth. We already talk about the fact that this issue particularly affects female and gender non-conforming journalists. There were some reports actually by the Committee to Protect Journalists and other organizations focusing on this question, on the question of rampant misogyny. There is abundant evidence collected by many organizations actually documenting this. I'm not going to add anything to it. It's just to get a sense of some recent reports that actually, in my mind, document pretty well this. I could go on and on and on of sort of recent reports and recent news stories on this question, and many of you already know this and are working on this subject, right? But it goes beyond that. It's not just about digital misogyny. It's about attacks that particularly target minority reporters in the U.S. African Americans. As far as I know, there is no still a comprehensive study on African American reporters. There is some evidence collected by different reporters on this. Same thing applies to Muslim reporters, Jewish reporters. So again, here you have that is sort of targeted to specific kinds of reporters. Second, the newsfeed. So who's more likely to be targeted is not only in terms of markers of social identity, but what is the subject that you cover. So here what we have is that reporters, and this is in the case of the U.S., reporters who cover national politics or cover stories related to intelligence, military issues, stories that are critical of the Trump administration, but I will say in more broadly of populist administrations, are more likely targets. And yesterday was the work of Maria Ressa was mentioned that it is not just about the U.S. It is something about the current sort of populist moment that in some ways help us understand what's going on. Also reporters who cover hot-button issues for conservative and far-right citizens, such as gun, immigration, white supremacy, are more likely to be targets of attacks. And third, news organizations. So, and the vast majority tend to be reporters working for mainstream news organizations. Or at least what traditionally in the United States we consider to be mainstream news organizations, some of the examples being displayed right here. Okay. So there is data actually showing that this is sort of like the more likely targets of these attacks. So the next question is, how does online harassment compare to offline and past forms of anti-press attacks? Right. Traditionally, even in the United States, who were the sources of the attacks? And in interviews with reporters and previous studies actually show this, were public officials, sometimes were sources. In other countries around the world were parastate actors, like drug traffickers, for example, or guerrilla movements. And it seems to me that we're seeing a shift, not because this is not the problem, this is the problem. But what we're dealing with here is a different sources of attacks. And I like to distinguish between instigators of attacks and citizens vigilantes who are the ones who actually conduct the attacks. So the instigators tend to be basically cable news, tabloids, talk radio personalities that are infused with critical language of the press in a very aggressive, very violent language. Politicians as well. I will not be, in the case of the United States, only President Trump, but a large number of politicians who consistently talk the language of dismissing, attacking, and even condoning forms of violence against the press, and as well as all right sides and forums that again tread on this anti-press language. And of course, who performs these attacks? And the evidence shows, and actually what I got from my interviews, is that tend to be vigilantes, citizens who believe they're doing some kind of justice by taking up on attacking specific reporters for their coverage, for who they are, what supposedly they believe in. Some of these are individual actions, and some are coordinated actions, what is called brigading, in which citizens team up, partner up, discuss ideas in different online forums, and conduct somewhat coordinated attacks. This is different from, let's say, government trolls, which is more typical in other parts of the world, in which governments or powerful politicians hire people or they have a system to actually conduct the attacks. Here, these forms of attacks suggest to me that we are seeing something different. That is not just the traditional way in which the attacks come from the state, right? Or the state is the one that fails to protect reporters. It's something that in some ways, it's a more mixed ways of top-down and bottom-up attacks. That in some ways, the kind of attacks that we're seeing now in the United States fit more of a mob mentality kind of attack, right? That is instigated by elite personalities, as well as discussed in different online forums, but ultimately is perpetrated by ordinary citizens who believe in what they are saying. And I'm just putting some pictures here, or more of the visual examples of this kind of mob mentality. I interview many reporters who have covered the Trump rallies, and it says this is exactly where it all comes together. Where basically you see the people who harass you online, you see their faces right there. The kind of vitriol, the kind of attacks, the kind of almost fist fights, almost like physical violence, not just rhetorical violence. And completely condoning by the rest. So, To me, what we are seeing now, this form of online harassment, is inseparable from the context of rising digital hate. In fact, I will say that what is happening to journalists is one of the manifestations of digital hate, and there are different ways we can see this. I understand by hate speech, just let me be clear about this, is expression that denies the basic status of other members of society as free and equal. It's the kind of speech that undermines the dignity of fellow human beings. Hate speech is responsible for contaminating, for poisoning the public well of communication. This is not unique to journalists, and there are a number of studies actually showing that certain members of parliament, particularly female members of parliament, human rights activists, scholars, right, are also likely victims of these kinds of attack. This is sort of more recent stories precisely on this question. So the point here is we're talking about journalism, but the phenomenon, the problem is broader because it is a manifestation of a bigger social trend. The turning point in the United States was this. So in my mind, at least part of the argument that I'm presenting here, is that journalism in some ways is, I'm sorry this metaphor has been used many times, but it is relative here, it is relevant here, which is the canary in the coal mine of conditions for public speech. And the reason is very simple, because journalism has a public profile, is easy to identify, is easy to reach, in ways that, let's say, many members of parliament or activists are as well. Okay? The turning point in the case of the United States was what happened in June 2018, when five journalists of the Annapolis Gazette, actually a newspaper close to where I live, were massacred by somebody who spoke in this language of hate, and the language of hate particularly targeting reporters. So this was a turning point, because it was just not only that it's a rhetorical attack, but actually something that is physical with sort of tragic consequences. So to me, this is from an academic perspective where I want to place this. I want to place this in the study in understanding the new conditions for hate speech. And of course, it parallels the rise of hate studies, which to me is illustrative of the times that we're living. The fact that people now define themselves as being, I'm a hate scholar, I study hate, right? Times will be different when people specialize in hug studies or kissing studies, right? Well, right now we are studying hate studies, right? What is unique about journalism? What is unique about journalism is, first of all, the demonization of the press, right? This is what reporters tell me. The language that they use is the language straight out of the president's rhetoric and many other prominent right-wing politicians. It is non-stop. There is a recent story many of you have seen in the New York Times about some of the patterns in President Trump tweeting. But it's not just that. It is something that is sort of, it crosses talk shows, right-wing talk shows. It is something that is central to the way that many Fox anchors talk about the media. This is sort of the demonization of the press in some ways prepares the ground for this kind of talk. A little known example is what happened to the Fresno Bee. The Fresno Bee is a newspaper in Central California. And after a series of investigations by the Fresno Bee, which is the traditional, very middle of the road, even with conservative editorial policies, has been the target of attacks, many reporters, many editors, who cover critically local Republican politicians. And this Fresno Bees is part of the title of a booklet that was distributed by the member of Congress, who is a prominent Trump supporter, Kevin Nunes. And he distributed this booklet to his voters, which is basically a 12-page booklet in which it demonizes the Fresno Bee. And mind you, the Fresno Bee is no radical right by any means. Is as middle of the road in the terms of American politics newspaper as it gets. The second reason is that journalism has become a political football under populism, has become something not only that sort of many politicians talk about as the enemy, right? But it's something that is related to a fracture in the trust of the press. Trust in the press in the United States is completely fractured by partisan identity and ideology. The trust of the press among Republicans and conservatives, the press is extremely, extremely low. It's significantly better, higher among liberals or Democratic-leaning voters. So it's hard to think that in this context, the press is anything, is perceived as anything like objective or neutral or even-handed. Even if journalists try to be that way to the best of their abilities, the press is increasingly perceived as being highly partisan, colored by personal and collective political and ideological identities. What are the consequences of this? And many of you already mentioned this. Consequences are personal trauma. We are still beginning to understand this problem and document what are the consequences of this. It's very difficult to study this for very good reasons. Second, it discourages reporters. What I'm finding out in my research is it's not that reporters sort of don't cover a story because of this, but they dial back on their publicity. They try not to be so public. They reduce their social media presence. They choose not to go to, let's say, CNN's or any of the networks to promote their story, even though they are expected to promote their stories on social media or on television. They try not to do it because they know that the more they do that, the more likely they're going to get harassed. Maybe they're not going to get more clicks on their story, but for sure, at least for 48 hours, they're going to become the center of these harassment campaigns. And in some ways, what also happens is they hide the stories. I interview a number of reporters that when they go to different parts of the country and say, I'm from the New York Times and the Washington Post, sometimes they don't want to say that, because if they say that, people won't talk to them. Once they say that, people say, oh, I hate you. I don't want to talk to you. Right? I talked to people who produce the coverage of the Trump rallies. They told me they remove all kinds of identifiers in the equipment that they work for NBC or for CNN, because in the past that equipment was damaged. Right? So in some ways, it's not censorship in the traditional way, but it's a way of limiting publicity, trying to go fly below the radar. But also the reluctance of sources to come forward or to go on the record, because they don't want to be publicly identified as somebody who talked to a New York Times or even a Wall Street Journal reporter. They are afraid of retaliation by other people who completely dismiss these news organizations. Okay, why it matters? Why is this important? The issue that theoretically I'm interested in here is the question of digital publicity and journalism. What these events actually show is the clash between ideals and the reality of journalistic practice. Let me explain what my argument is on this regard. The ideal will be of journalism trying to be more transparent, more accountable, right? Trying to be sort of accountable to the public by showing how journalism actually works. What is the clash? The clash is that the more you do that, the more vulnerable you are to attacks. And this is something that we have not considered or discussed sufficiently. So the argument is, if you remember one slide of all the slides, please remember this one. That the online harassment actually reflects journalism's complex relation with publicity in the digital society. For a long time, we journalism scholars had an almost even, I would say, somewhat simplistic notion of the relationship between journalism and publicity. That journalism should help publicity, and journalism should be much more public, more transparent, more accountable. What we're seeing now is the paradox of that situation. Let me explain this to this. What happens when journalism opens itself to the public? We all expected great things to happen. Public better informed, journalists more accountable, journalists consulting with readers. You know, wonderful days were ahead. Now, after 10, 15 years of this almost natural experiment, we can say, well, not so much. So look, for example, at the literature on readers' comments. What has happened when journalism reluctantly and then willingly open up stories to readers' comments? Or what happens when citizens share their stories? The evidence is mixed, to give it a positive tone. Responses by news organizations is that exactly not what came up was what many expected. That what actually came up when journalism became much more open in terms of the stories, what to do with the stories, providing comment, is actually more of a mixed bag rather than this more virtuous developments. And there are a number of recent studies, I'm showing just a few, actually showing this. And eventually, what happened? Many news organizations say, well, thanks for the comments, but we're shutting down the comments, especially when the stories are too controversial or very sensitive, because we don't want to open in ways that will undermine our work with people who will post hate or will engage in a shouting match. So here, news organizations have been in a catch-22. Catch-22 is, on the one hand, we want to promote audience engagement, news engagement, right? We heard this at least for the last 10, 15 years. What happens is that news engagement brings up all the good things and all the really bad things that we have in society, right? So what to do about this? Well, comments are close. Or we manage commentary very, very closely. How is this connected to online harassment? In my mind, these are two ways of thinking about the relationship between journalism and the public, journalism and publicity. Because it happens that once you open up journalism, all kinds of things will happen that not necessarily are democratic or not necessarily are related to anything related to a recent dialogue or pluralism. So what are the solutions to digital harassment? And many people already mentioned a few things. So yes, most of us agree online harassment should end. I don't think that anybody here will doubt that proposition. But it seems to me that the problem is not just a question of journalistic safety, as important as it is. It's about the dilemmas of abandoned speech. Online harassment reveals not just what happens when journalism is more open to the public, that good things and really bad things happen, but it's about the dilemmas of abandoned speech. What happens, and this is what happened in the last 20 years, when you have more speech? Well, this is where the debate is these days. On the one hand, we have a position that we can identify as free speech orthodoxy, the one that says more speech will prevail over bad speech, the traditional, let's say, American jurisprudence and philosophy in this, and then different kinds of speech regulation to minimize harm. But I think there is a time, because journalism is essential to this, whether or not is more speech the right response to noxious speech. Journalists ask themselves that question. Should I engage with hate speech? Should I do it? What is the purpose of that? Will I prevail with better speech? Will prevail over hateful speech? And let me tell you what journalists typically do. So they ask all these questions. Should journalists engage with hate speech? Should you engage with somebody who calls you all kinds of names, who demean your humanity, in the name of reasonable free speech? Does kind of speech work? We have a wonderful and terrible natural experiment again. We have more speech. Has more speech prevailed over bad speech? Is more speech needed? Is plenty of speech already there? Do we have plenty of more speech already? Who has time anyway? Journalists said, I don't have time to engage in a conversation with people who defame me, who just, you know, eviscerated my humanity, to tell them I'm working for the benefit of the public and these are the facts of what I reported. Who has time to do that? Let alone the philosophical inclination to engage in that kind of debate. I'm beginning to think the following. I don't want to be too pessimistic, so I'm trying to find the optimism wherever I can find it. So is it a problem that needs to be confronted? Not because we're going to win, but we need to confront it, not necessarily because it will be solved. because we're dealing with one of the most formidable sort of challenges that democratic communication deals with. What are the responses? There are a number of responses, and many of you know this better than I do, so I will not cover that. I like to group the responses in three kinds: individual, collective, and social responses. What are individual responses? Something that you do on your own. Some reporters I interview, they call it, I'm a strategic avoider. I avoid it. I don't read it. When I see email or something on Twitter that is against me, it was full of hate, I just ignore it. I don't engage with it. You can't. Right? Or the idea that you have to develop a thicker skin, as a recent study actually shows. You know, to be a journalist these days is an individual solution. Grow a thicker skin. Right? Because, well, that's the new normal. And, you know, very difficult, very unlikely anything will change. And the idea that this shall pass through. After 48 hours, if you're not again on the cover of the New York Times, no one will remember you. So hang in there. 48 hours is going to be ugly. People are going to say all kinds of things about you, especially if you go on CNN or, you know, some invisible television network. But then, you know, you will be okay. So that's an individual answer, right? Individual response. The second one is more of a collective response, which has to do with how journalists themselves or come up with ways to protect against harassment. And many of you are experts on this, so I will not cover this because I think many of you will talk about it. And then there's the social response, meaning the social is what society does about this. And this is a much more difficult issue. Public regulation depends on different traditions. There's a tradition of path dependency in different societies about ways to deal with hate speech. Corporate regulation, and we're in the middle of that conversation. Some of that was said earlier. Most of these attacks, at least in the reporters that I encounter, comes to Twitter and Facebook, and to a lesser extent by email. So yes, platforms should do something about it. They're responsible for like being the vehicle, the channel, for much of this hate. I'm of the persuasion that this is a whack-a-mole kind of thing. For those who know that wonderful game. Meaning because the haters appear in different places. You get rid of one place, they show up somewhere else. You deplatform them somewhere, they show up in a different places. You know, Facebook will do something to prevent any kind of doxing, they will show up somewhere else. So it's a very dynamic, shape-shifting movement. So to me, and this is moving toward the conclusions, journalism, in some ways, is presenting what the dilemmas of abandoned speech is, in which we can have criticism without civility. Criticism is all fine, but this kind of criticism comes with hate, rather than with a legitimate concern for establishing a conversation with reporters over their work. It's agonism without deliberation. It's just conflict without the opportunity, without the interest in engaging in any exchange of ideas. Is conflict for the sake of conflict, which is basically what I said in other papers, what populism is about. Populism is a purely conflicted notion of politics. That politics are about conflict. It's not about conflict in order to find deliberation to address some common concerns or find some common ground. That doesn't fit in this logic. So the conclusions are that dystopian, anti-democratic speech is inevitable amid the communication chaos. What is the problem here? The problem here is what many authors have argued about hate speech. Hate speech is undemocratic because it silences speech. It discourages people from speaking, particularly minorities, particularly more vulnerable citizens. Because it's not interested in dialogue. It's just interested in speech just for the sake of speech. So online harassment, that's what I'm saying. We are dealing with a very huge problem here. It goes way beyond journalism. Because you reveal the paradox of the problems of digital publicity. If you as a reporter, you make yourself more public, more available, and you cover the issues, and you are, what I already mentioned, you are more likely to be the target of attacks. That is what you get in return. The approaches and solutions are context dependent. And I don't think that we have enough evidence yet to see what works in some countries, what might work somewhere else. We have to be attentive. We need this sort of bifocal vision. That some of the problems may be similar around the world, but the actions, what could work, actually may be different. I mean, there might be some similarities because there are important contextual differences. And this is my last slide. I think we have to get over the following. Lately we have heard this idea that misinformation or hate is something that we have to live with. Mr. Mark Zuckerberg last week said about misinformation, a few weeks ago, so in campaign, as something we have to live with. There's nothing we can do about it. Take chances and grow a thick skin. Republicans love to say, get over it. Don't be a snowflake. Man up. Really? Is that the best we can do? Right? Is that the best we can do? Say, you know what? You know, welcome to the new sort of digital society. This is the new normal. And I think what we need is to understand the viability of virtuous paths of action for plural and tolerant societies. We cannot just say grow a thicker skin. We cannot rely on individual solutions to a collective problem. So what I propose is that we need to understand the multiple dimensions of this collective problem that we're facing and try to figure out what are viable collective actions. And I've not been more precise on this because I think the debate is exactly what might work in some contexts may not be viable somewhere else, and also because really, really, we don't have a silver bullet how to address the complexity of digital hate, in which journalism, unfortunately, are sort of prime targets, are sitting ducks for this kind of toxic speech. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Silvio, for that very well-informed and quite intriguing speech, which I find responded perfectly to our panel last night as well, and that you managed perfectly to place the new conditions for hate speech within an academic context. Lots of things to reflect upon, and we wonder, well, at least you're raising awareness about probably telling us that the famous canary in the coal mine is not doing so very well, but that we should not accept that new normal.
Right.
I'm sure there are comments, questions to Silvio's speech. And I'm waiting for hands. I see two hands in the corner up there. Three. Okay. Four. Five. Let's take those five. Start in the corner.
Okay. Luis Benitez from El Salvador. Thank you, Silvio, for this presentation. I think it's very good for reflecting about some of the points that you include in your presentation. I have many questions, but of course, I want to focus on one. Many of the people are going to ask you. You know, one of the things that I'm reflecting on your presentation is that what we call sometimes the generation divide. Because this new normal, maybe it's a position from the people that is not millennial, but for the millennial, maybe this is not the new, it's just normal. So I don't know if in your research or in your thinking, how do you see the generation perspective in this issue?
This is so new that even for my former students from 5 years ago, when they started 5 years ago, none of this existed. Mm-hmm. Now, this is like every day, again, depending on what subject. So it's not even a generational difference. The new normal is for people even in their late 20s, when they started 5-7 years ago, you know, it was not, you know, as a woman, yes, harassment existed from sources, but not this constant, especially if you cover one of these quote-unquote sensitive subjects. So it's new for everybody. People likely to say it's 2016, but 2016 in some ways it is sort of or Gamergate. Gamergate is in some ways was a turning point in the legitimation of certain digital behaviors vis-a-vis women, right? So this is brand new. This is not something that, you know, people from, you know, it's only people 40s and 50s say, well, this did not happen when they started Johnson. Even people started Johnson 5 years ago, it didn't have the kind of magnitude it has now. That would be my answer.
Hi. My name is Hannah Diboykat. I am a lecturer at Arab American University in Palestine. Actually, I would like to... my comment would be about what we need to do, your last question. I will tell you about some, if you give me 4 minutes, about an experience I happened to with me before, 2 months ago. I live in Ramallah. I went to visit my family in Nablus. So the settlers, the Israeli settlers, attacked my car and smashed it with stones. In the car was my little daughter. It was at 9 o'clock at the evening. Actually, I get over this, but. After the attack, immediately I start my life on Facebook and tell hi people. I had an accident. It was like this, and me and my daughter now okay. I don't know how I started my life on Facebook. I don't know how I drove my car, and I don't know how it was the crazy situation, but. As I said, I get over it. What I couldn't get over, the video goes viral on internet, on social media. People start comments in Palestine, Palestinian people all over the region. It was most of the messages, the comments I received, it was hate messages. This is what I couldn't really get over. This is what really affected me till now. When I remember, I couldn't read the whole messages and comments I received. Okay, I got warm, supportive comments, but there were thousands of hate messages. Really, social media, it is a hate machine. As Leonardo yesterday said, my question is, what we need is, I couldn't imagine how journalist women could deal when they really work in the field, how they could deal with all these messages. So I think we need to train these people how to pass these things.
Thank you, Anon, for sharing that. Silvio, if you could take a couple of more questions,
sure.
Come up, make
yes.
Little notes. And please, we don't have very much time, so please be to the point and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. Silvio, thank you very much for the presentation. I'm over here. I can see you're looking up. So, hello. So my name is Thomas Hughes. I'm the Executive Director of Basketball 19. Really interesting. I think, for me, the core of what you're presenting, what you presented to us, is around what is hate speech, and what is information and disinformation, and this very tricky problem that under international standards there are levels of hate speech which are technically legal, and misinformation and disinformation is technically not illegal. So we have, in essence, a problem with international standards if we want to move this broadly. I wanted to throw a question to you, adding a fourth level of response to what you outlined, looking at it more from a technology perspective. So a lot of the tech giants, Facebook specifically, have been looking at ways in which they can deal with broad sections of hate speech through algorithmic treatment of content. And essentially what they're planning to do, as I understand it, is to start to reduce engagement on content which comes close to, but doesn't necessarily cross a legal threshold of hate speech. So that is, de facto, a form of censorship. So I'd like to get your opinion on that, if you think that's a viable solution to the problem. The other question is, and I guess it's a broader question for the whole room, but do we want these companies to apply international standards? Because essentially, the full push of what we see through public discourse at the moment in the United States and around the world, actually, is in a direction that we do not want them to apply international standards. Because if we do, what Mark Zuckerberg said is correct. It's a messy ecosystem. We're not going to make it perfect. It is whack-a-mole. Accept the fact it's whack-a-mole. And that is, to a degree, human nature. Or are we going to say, no, we should allow them to have a different threshold. We should look at something more restrictive on life.
Thank you, Thomas. We'll take two more questions, and then Silvio will sum up before the break.
We should perhaps have a few questions on that side as well.
Go ahead. And the last question will be from that side of the room.
Hansen, thank you so much for this overarching narrative. I mean, you've raised so many concerns and questions about the future. I have one simple question, adding the comparative aspect. You know, if we think of Halley and Machine's work, for example, how they analyze the political cultures that explain lots of the instability online. I wonder how the in the U.S. society, where we're always thinking of normative deliberations, democracy, how you can explain that decline? Has it been always like that, just below the online surface? And the online gave that because it's so anonymous, you know, you are much emboldened to write and type things that you wouldn't say in real life, you know. So maybe you can share your, or has it changed? Has political culture itself changed? So I'm asking about, you know, the effect of the medium and how it reflects society.
And the very last question, I want to challenge our students. Did I see any students? Hands? Everybody's looking down.
If not, that's not my idea.
Okay, you lost that opportunity. Okay. Yes, Gabby.
Thank you. My name is Gabby Nielsen. I'm a retired documentary filmmaker from Norwegian Broadcasting. And threatening is one of the groups I was threatened in the mid-70s when I first did a documentary on immigrants in Norway. At that time, I was actually able to pressure NRK to file complaints to the police, not only for myself, but also for two of the people in my documentary. So I want to ask, how often should we actually pressure the media companies to file complaints against harassment and especially against sex?
So just
and sort of balance that to freedom of speech.
There is no rule without an exception. This is the very last question, and you'll be very brief. Thank you.
You talked about, in your conclusion, you talked about, I'm a freelance journalist, my name is Monica, collective action. Because it demands collective action. I was wondering if you had any examples of newsrooms coming together to actually do that. And please.
Thank you. And then I'll leave the floor for
I will try to be very quick.
I'm
standing between you and food, so it's never a good idea to be in the middle. So thank you all. Great questions. We'll see if I can be very, very brief about it. On the first point, I'm really sorry about what happened to you, and to me shows that actually your story reminds me that there is so much the journalists can do to minimize the attacks, but in some ways the phenomenon is so much bigger. Hate is always very creative in trying to find ways to sort of shame people, right? That is, I mean, we can focus on what needs to be done, let's say on certain precautions, but we have a collective mob that hates you for whatever reasons, to me shows the sort of the ingenuity in which sort of hate can spread. I'm just saying this not to be a downer, but actually to have a sense of the magnitude of
of the problem. Your example to me illustrates that we need to sort of think very ambitiously on this question. Otherwise, we may solve a problem but not dealing with the magnitude of this question. Second, Thomas said, yes, I absolutely agree with you. I will think of technology as being woven through these three kind of responses rather than being by itself. I like to think in terms of level of action. And yes, I think that if I heard correctly what you said, I share your doubts about applying international standards because of path dependency, because the tradition in terms of speech regulation around the world is so different, and good ideas can be used for evil, for bad by governments, and the justification that we are quote unquote regulating it. So I understand that, and that's why I'm sort of very reluctant to think about any kind of universal approaches to dealing with this problem, even though the problems on the surface look very similar, and some of the platforms are the same platforms through which sort of hate sort of widely circulates. And the question to me is how you, one doesn't leave the platforms off the hook, but at the same time understand that the problem is much bigger than the platforms. And to me, the platforms in some ways don't want to know the extent to which they are home for hate. Because once they know that and document that, they are really responsible. They cannot say, they're kind of claiming innocence. Someone made this argument that in some ways, and I think it's the right argument, the social media company operates the way that tobacco companies operated for a long time. They didn't want to do any research on the health consequences of tobacco. Because if they had information and they decided to continue doing what they were doing, or doing worse than that, at least in the US, they could be liable in ways that, so they say, like, we don't want to know what's going on. Right? And that's what we need to do, to really document this. Journalists need to, news organizations need to document hate. It's not something that, oh, it happened to you, poor you, I'm very sorry. No, we need to produce the data, how they actually function as hate machines. On another question, the magnitude is new, but what is not new is hate. This great book called The Race Beat, about how the American journalism covered the civil rights movement, and this is like plenty of documentation about how reporters working for a variety of newspapers, white and African-American reporters, were consistently the target of attacks and hate and surveillance by government agencies. So it's not new. I mean, there's this story about the land of for free, et cetera, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a myth, right? I'm not saying it's the same as everywhere else in the world. So the question is that understanding what is new in a country that has a very troubled history. If you look at the history of the African-American press, it was typical for African-American reporters to be lynched for the burning of African-American newspapers, right? 100 years ago, during the Jim Crow era. So it's a country with a long history of violence, particularly violence against reporters. John Rowe wrote this book a few years ago, about a decade ago right now, that actually talks about that as well. And on your question, to me the problem is how little news organizations know about this or really want to know about this problem. There's complete lack of awareness. Even reporters don't feel like informing this to the editors or somebody on top. First issue. Lack of awareness is a real problem. Nothing can be done unless higher-ups really take ownership of this problem. Second, the news organizations tend to see it as a safety problem, something to report to the police, as opposed to a free speech issue. You see the difference? They might intervene when they feel that might escalate, and you might get something to what we saw in the Annapolis Gazette last year. And that's a legitimate concern. But this is related to questions about freedom of the press and free speech. It's not just about the safety. So maybe I mean, that is to me something that more work needs to be done, not at the level of awareness of reporters, but upper management, publishers, really owning this question. And collective action, I don't have a blueprint that it will be, I'm sorry, stupid for me to actually say this. It's something that needs to come up from reporters and reporters' organizations, and many people are already working on this. I can tell you a little bit about what has been done in a different context in Latin America, but many of you already know some of these stories, about trying to figure out, it's not a problem that happens to you, so you have to break the silence, figure out what happened, and then figure out all kinds of sort of collective answers to this, and involve the state, not just involving the police, to protect, you know, safety, right? That is my sort of probably easy answer to a very complex question about what needs to be done. Thank you very much. Thank you.